Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. War has broken out in northern Ethiopia in the Tigray region, and fighting continues despite a tentative ceasefire. What is the cause of the war, and what are the implications for the nation and the region? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In November, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed launched what he called a law and order operation targeting domestic terrorists in the Tigray region in the north of Ethiopia. It was quickly clear, with large deployments of Ethiopian National Defense Forces and aerial bombardments, that this was a military campaign. By November 28th, federal forces had taken control of the region's capital and had declared victory. But militia resistance and intense fighting have marked the region since the campaign began. Meanwhile, over 60,000 refugees have fled the country. Nearly 500,000 people have been displaced and are in desperate need of assistance. Critical infrastructure has been destroyed, and credible reports of atrocities and war crimes continue to trickle out of the region. Foreign fighters have also come to the country, and it threatens to expand beyond its borders throughout the region. On today's show, we examine the cause of the Ethiopian war, its impact on the nation and the region, and prospects for resolution. Our panel is Ali Virgi, non-resident senior advisor to the Africa program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He is the author of Five Steps to Sustain a Ceasefire in Northern Ethiopia. And Anne Fitzgerald, director of the Balsillie School of International Affairs and a professor in Wilfrid Laurier's University's Political Science Department. She is the author of Ethiopia, A New Proxy Battle Space. Thank you both for joining us. Ali Virgi, let's start with you. What's the cause of this war?
Thank you, Douglas. There are both proximate causes and there are longer-term causes to which the situation has been building. The proximate cause was this military dispute over the control of military assets in the northern province of Tigray between the federal government and the Tigrayan forces. But the longer term causes are about a difference of vision over the future of the country. There has been, since the change in government that occurred in Ethiopia in 2018, a lot of discontent amongst the Tigrayans and the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front in particular, which once ruled Ethiopia and was replaced by Abiy Ahmed and a new political party. And the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, retreated effectively to Tigray. They didn't join the new governing arrangement, and they more or less differed with the new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, on every issue that came up since then. And where this came to a head was about a year ago when the federal government decided that because of the coronavirus pandemic, it could not hold elections. And so it delayed elections for a year. And the Tigrayans took the view that his administration was no longer legitimate because it had exceeded its term of office. And they went ahead and held their own elections in their own region. And they said, well, we're not going to recognize the federal government anymore. And from there, relations steadily deteriorated. There were various measures and countermeasures. And this culminated in the collapse that we've seen more recently of security and the outbreak of hostilities.
And Fitzgerald, it seems certainly that part of what's been driving this conflict is ethnic differences within Ethiopia and the governance patterns within Ethiopia. Is it fair to describe this as an ethnic conflict?
Yes, I mean, it is an ethnic conflict in so much as one ethnicity that retreated back to the region of Tigray in all forms and capacities, governance capacity, retired military capacity, and other forms rose up and became responsible for an attack that was launched on the federal forces in November. It's also ethnic because of the model, that the TPLF dominated EPRDF government developed and believed in very fiercely over the years. Ironically, the same model which now TPLF leaders are speaking out against because of the representation that model in its constitutional interpretation would give to the party and to the region. So on the other hand, looking at Ethiopia in terms of ethnic divisions is not an optimal way of trying to manage the politics and manage the resilience and growth and development of the country going forward. Ethiopia is a country of mixed heritage, mixed marriages. And, you know, we saw in the recent federal election a real show of democracy amongst the population that was eligible to vote. Okay, it wasn't a perfect election. Not everybody voted in, but it certainly was a big step up to the kind of numbers that had come out to vote before. We've also seen the issue of ethnic divisions play a very, very minimal role when it's come to providing for the humanitarian and food effort, 70% of which was catered for by the country in support of the region. The other nine regions really came together to give logistical reinforcements, vehicles, medical aid, food aid, et cetera. So yes, there has been a model of an ethnic federalist model, but over time and more, and particularly since the political reforms of 2018, 2019 that have given voices in the five regions which were voiceless under the EPRDF's ethnic federalist model, we've seen ethnic divisions play less of a role in the progress of politics.
The TPLF, that's the Tigrayan Popular Liberation Front or People's Liberation Front, representing the Tigrayan, you know, political interests, had dominated the country until relatively recently. Ali Virgi, is this a case of an ethnic group that had dominated politics who are now on the outs wanting to return back to power? Or is it a bit more complex than that?
I don't think that would be quite fair to say that that's the only reason or the only objective of the TPLF. And I think it's also important to say that the TPLF and indeed the other ethnic parties shouldn't be conflated with representing everyone from that ethnicity. As Anne has said, ethnicity is fluid. There's lots of mixing, and certainly we're talking very much about political. The TPLF and the new administration of the federal government had very different views about the way in which the country should be governed and led and the decisions that should be taken. And one of the things that the new prime minister has done since 2018 is actually undo a lot of the, or start to undo a lot of the policies and strategies that the TPLF had put in place since it was in power. And clearly ruling a region as opposed to ruling the whole country has changed the prospects for the TPLF. And so there are certainly some within the TPLF have better aspirations, but I think there's also a recognition in the party that they weren't necessarily going to be in a position to rule Ethiopia as a whole. That said, they weren't happy with the way in which the country was being led. And so there is this complexity of power in terms of why the conflict has happened, but also, as I've said, this vision for why it should continue to be organized the way it is. I differ a little bit with what Anne said about the TPLF attacking or not being happy with the model of federalism, the new administration that has a lot less certain commitment to this ethnic federal model and has actually voiced its intention, its desire to change it and to look for something else, because they argue that the ethnic federal model is very divisive and pits people against each other. If the war has taken, unfortunately, some ethnic dimension for many Tigrayans, both in the TPLF and outside of it, it reinforced this idea that ethnic identity is of paramount importance, perhaps even more important than national identity. And for others in Ethiopia who are opposed or have had problems with the way in which the TPLF once ruled the country, it is, again, easy to situate yourself in terms of saying there shouldn't be a TPLF structure, or the ethnic structure of the Tigrayans is for purpose.
So, Anne Fitzgerald, at least part of what I've been reading about in this conflict then is about this question of federalism versus centralism within the government. Is that fair to say that ultimately what Abiy Ahmed has tried to do is to try to centralize the government, try to govern it more as a centralized entity? What exactly is that relationship between the regions, the different ethnic regions in the central government?
Well, it's, you know, I'm speaking to you from Canada, and we have a federal system here. It doesn't mean that there's the same arrangement for every province in Canada in terms of its relationship with the center. In fact, one province, Quebec, has a very asymmetrical relationship with the center. It has different pension laws, it has different labor laws, etc. So under the former ethnic federalism model, you had, you know, four dominant parties and therefore four dominant regions. And as a professor of international security, I look at the security governance situation. And there were regional security sectors that were quite independent of the center. They had a direct line to the regional presidents. And this differs somewhat to the United States model and other models where there are regional security entities, but there are two lines. There's one to the center and there's one to the regions. So when there are political differences within the regions at the regional level, and there's only one line of command between those security forces and the regional president, then when the region differs in views to the center view, then you have grounds for a conflict instantly between the regional security forces, who are loyal to the regional president, and the federal security forces. And this is, in fact, what we saw happening. And over and above that, the independence of these forces, and it wasn't just in Tigray, there were other regions that saw manpower and weapons accumulation and buildup go beyond the constitutional limits allowed of it in legislation. So I think some of the political reforms were meant to give some of the other regions voices, better representation in parliament. And this is exceedingly important for a country as diverse as Ethiopia. Over 80 different ethnically different groups and distinct languages and dialects. And that representation across parliament is very much needed. So the political voices across the wider country are needed to enable those voices in parliament and civil society and across the whole societal structures.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing conflict in Ethiopia with Ali Verji of the U.S. Institute for Peace and Anne Fitzgerald of Wilfrid Laurier University. So far, the conversation has been relatively quaint in conversation about the nature of institutions and federalism within Ethiopia, but the reality is an actually rather brutal conflict taking place, fighting in the northern part of the country. So, Ali Verji, the way a lot of this has been framed is the irony of the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed winning the Nobel Peace Prize and then in such a short fashion seemingly, you know, launching a military campaign against a region within his country. Is that an irony? Is there some sort of connection there? How should we interpret this, a Nobel Prize winner seemingly choosing a military option?
It's a very jarring set of circumstances, and that's certainly the appearance that it gives to many. I think we need to look first at what was the prize for. And the reason the prize was awarded is very much connected to the conflict that we see today, in that the prize was awarded in large part because of Abiy Ahmed's attempts to find reconciliation with Eritrea, Ethiopia's neighbor to the north. And Eritrea and Ethiopia once fought a very brutal war as well, around 1998-2000, just over 20 years ago. And that war, although it ended in 2000, it didn't really end with a peace. It ended with a Cold War, if we could say, a continuation of very bitter relations between the government of Ethiopia, at that time under the TPLF, and the government of Eritrea. What Abiy Ahmed did when he came to power was he made it his priority to normalize that relationship. One of the key things that normalization required, from the Eritrean perspective in particular, was acceptance of a decision by an international commission over where the boundary between Ethiopia and Eritrea should be. And until Abiy Ahmed came to power, the previous government had refused to honor that ruling. And one of the reasons that they had refused to honor that ruling was because it directly affected the Tigrayan state. And as we've said, the TPLF was the most important part of the government at that stage. Abiy Ahmed did not have this concern in the same way that the TPLF did. And so he said, we'll honor the ruling. And this unlocked the door to normalization of relations with Eritrea. There were other steps as well, but this was one of the most important ones. And in recognition of honoring that commitment and normalizing this relationship, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee decided that he should be the laureate. So if you look at it from that perspective, you see that the prize was given for a very specific, limited, important, but limited and defined decision. It wasn't that there was recognition that, for example, all of Ethiopia's problems were being solved peacefully, because even at that time, there were some very serious subnational security challenges in other parts of the country. And so one of the ways to interpret the prize from Abiy Ahmed's perspective was that this was validation of his approach. He was doing the right thing. And consequently, as a result of that international validation and this very prestigious award, he perhaps felt emboldened to continue to look for ways to address what he saw as the wrongs of his predecessors. And so if you look at the speech that he gave in Oslo when he received the prize, he said things like, war is terrible, I know the pain of war because I myself have been involved in a war. And the war he was referring to was this Eritrea-Ethiopia conflict. But another way to read his words with the benefit of hindsight is to say, well, actually, he was saying that under some circumstances, war is justified and there are legitimate purposes for it. And so while that wasn't necessarily the focus of analysis of the speech or of the award at the time, and even now isn't necessarily the focus of what people think about when the Nobel Prize is mentioned, it is important in perhaps understanding the psyche, the mentality of the man, of the leader, and why he feels justified in doing what has happened in Tigray over the last 7 or 8 months.
And there seems to be another element to that story as well, with the resolution of the conflict, this border dispute with Eritrea. The Eritreans seemingly are playing a substantial role in this war in Tigray. Eritreans appear to be, you know, in the conflict, fighting alongside Abiy Ahmed's military fight against the Tigrayans. First of all, what does that mean, and how does that frame this question of bringing peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea?
Well, I think there is a really blurred understanding and still ongoing confusion about the precise role that Eritrea has played in this conflict. There have been sightings of Eritrean soldiers in the region. There have been accusations of Eritrean military uniforms being manufactured in textile factories in the region. There are refugees, tens of thousands, unaccounted for, and thousands of prisoners that have been released from prisons that are unaccounted for. And so we don't know the full extent of the number of Eritrean soldiers that have been involved. We don't know the full extent of where those soldiers have moved the extent to which they have been operating alongside of ENDF forces. The line from the government has been that they were never invited to join. But I think absolute transparency on that issue from the outset did not serve Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed well when he did start to acknowledge that Eritrean troops were pulling out and moving back, because that de facto recognized that they were playing a role in the region. I think what was also true was when the ENDF forces were deployed to respond to the attack on the Northern Command and were launched under the auspices of the law enforcement operation. Part of the reason why some troops got to the region so quickly was because of the support that Eritrea gave for them to land in the country and move in across the border from there. Now, this isn't inconceivable. Neighboring countries often have military cooperation pacts and agreements to support each other when in need. But this is a highly, highly sensitive issue for reasons that Ali covered earlier. Because of the lack of resolution along the boundary line between the two countries. And even though peace was brokered, and this is the issue with Nobel Peace Prize awards, they are often done at the early stages of somebody's efforts. And what would have been ideal would have been for that peace to have been a bit more mature, the resolution of the boundary agreement, the land being handed back in more of a ceremonial way, in a way that was presented to Parliament and made transparent with Parliament, in a way that included the communities that would be affected by this new demarcation. And that wasn't enabled because of the TPLF's lack of cooperation with the federal government, not allowing people into the region, not agreeing to hand back a lot of the artillery and the military buildup along the border. And so it was a situation that was destined to escalate in some way.
And Ali Verji, one of the great concerns with this conflict, actually conflict throughout this region, in the Horn of Africa region and the Northeastern Africa, has been these rather porous borders and the increased number of international interventions in these conflicts, considering the size and importance of Ethiopia. How valid is the concern that this could easily become much more than just the Ethiopian civil war, but possibly a regional conflict, an African world war even?
I think that's going a bit far to say that there would be a world war out of it. I think the fact is that Ethiopia has quite complicated relations with most of its neighbors, and that hasn't changed with the new government being in place, or the government of Abiy Ahmed. What has changed is that the nature of those relations has evolved in some cases. And so to take an example, Ethiopia and Sudan to the west of Ethiopia had reasonably good relations prior to Abiy Ahmed's coming to power. And certainly in the initial period of the Abiy government, the relations with Sudan were also quite good. But today they're very strained. They're strained for a number of reasons. They're strained because of differences of opinion about the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, this large hydroelectric dam that Ethiopia has been building on the Blue Nile, which eventually flows into Sudan and then further downstream into Egypt. It's also become a tense relationship because of the war in Tigray. Initially, the Sudanese honored a request from the federal government of Ethiopia to not allow there to be any movement across the border of goods or supplies that could potentially help the TPLF in its fight against the federal government. But very quickly thereafter, the Sudanese, to some extent, took advantage of the situation and occupied an area that is contested along the Sudan-Ethiopia border. And depending on who you speak to, the Sudanese would say, well, this is our territory. And if you ask many people who have a more favorable perspective to Ethiopia, they would say this is Ethiopian territory. The point is that there was this change in relationship which allowed for this border dispute to flare up. But if you look elsewhere, if you look at Ethiopia-Somalia relations, for example, they're not very much changed by relations over Tigray. They're not changed very much by the situation in Tigray. If you look at Ethiopia-Djibouti relations, they're not changed very much by the situation in Tigray. If you look at Ethiopia's relations with other countries in the wider region, they're also not changed very much by what's happening in Tigray. It doesn't mean that other countries aren't concerned, but it doesn't mean that they're going to become directly involved in the conflict either. So the Tigray conflict has changed or has affected Ethiopia's relationship with Sudan. It's of course changed and affected Ethiopia's relationship with Eritrea, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to become a wider regional or pan-regional war.
So, Johannes, I will ask you first, I know that there has been an election in Ethiopia. So first, what's the status of that election and how's that turned out? And my understanding is they haven't completely finished counting all the votes.
So the election just concluded in a very peaceful manner, which is something a bit surprising. I'm actually pleased that it's a peaceful election, but there were so many fears because of the conflict that's been going on in Tigray and also unrest in Western Oromia, which is an area known as Wollega. There has been lots of conflicts because of the Oromo Liberation Army insurgency there. So there were some kind of fear that it may negatively impact the electoral process, but it turned out to be a peaceful one. But at the same time, when you look at how the election basically appeared to be, whether it was free and fair, there had been some challenges because of some Oromo political parties boycotting the election in Oromia, so which is the largest region in the country. So the incumbent political party, Prosperity Party, which is led by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, was always in a position to win in Oromia because there was much contest against it. But the election in the capital city, in much of the southern region, and of course the Amhara region, was, you know, expected to be very, very competitive. And what the preliminary official results from the electoral board show that in Addis Ababa, the capital, the Prosperity Party, which is Abiy's party, has won overwhelmingly. And the opposition political parties, despite the fact that they had some complaints here and there, were very much receptive to the results. And in what's very interesting outcome, I believe, is in the Amhara region, an area known as Gondar, which is mostly known for It is racist pan-Ethiopian attitude. You see also similar, a very similar result to that of Addis Ababa, and you see that the Prosperity Party won there. And in some areas, a newly emerging nationalist, Amhara Nationalist Party won. So despite these challenges here and there, because of boycotting of elections in Oromia, and of course unrest in some parts of the country, the election actually concluded very much peacefully. And in fact, many Ethiopians, especially those in government, have been complaining that despite the fact that they were able to have a free and fair election, a largely peaceful election, it was something that should have been praised by the international community and partners across the globe, but no one really covered it as much as it should have been, And as Ali was saying, they were just making the Tigray conflict to be more than what it actually is in terms of affecting the region at large. So, the election, in short, was a very successful one at the end.
So, Johannes had referenced how international actors have responded. And Fitzgerald, how have international actors responded to the conflict, to the election, and to this campaign? In particular, how has the U.S. responded? And is there kind of a consistency among the Western Alliance on what to do about Ethiopia?
I think many of us in the scholarly community have been quite shocked at the response from the international community on Ethiopia. Ethiopia is a long-term ally of the international community, is one of the founders of the League of Nations, one of the founders of and host to the African Union. It's the second most populous country in Africa. It has been a recipient of donor support for many years now. And, if we go on to the external actors side, I don't think we're particularly well-tooled these days to have all the right responses to these sorts of conflicts that break out during democratic transitions. We either express concern, condemnation, or support, or use more coercive measures like sanctions or send in intervention forces. And the situation in Ethiopia was we don't see a lot of transitions that are characterized by leadership transition within the same party that accounts for such a significant political transformation and a steer in a different direction as well. And I think that going back to 2018 really required more support than anybody thought. It was inevitable that Victor Vanquish politics would break out. But I think we're seeing quite an aggressive mood towards Ethiopia by some partners that have spoken out using aggressive words, using accusations that for which the evidence base is very questionable on some issues. In other parts, we've seen testimonies being given in Washington and elsewhere that to the scholarly community really reflect a lack of knowledge and understanding, not only of Ethiopian political culture, the security apparatus, but also the social systems in Ethiopia. And what makes all this very complicated is, in some cases, at worst, disinformation and misinformation across the media and analysts. Some analysts are doing a fantastic job as well. But with the layer of social media that is put onto this, and bearing in mind we've always lived with misinformation and disinformation, social media takes it to another level. And so we're seeing multidimensional conflict here. There's a ground-based conflict and ground-based tensions, and there's a conflict going on in the virtual space as well. And there are splits not just within the Ethiopian borders, but within the diaspora community as well, different narratives being given. And the danger of narratives that are ill-evidenced is that once they are spoken and once they are ingrained, they're very difficult to shift away from. And so, you know, we see this kind of response towards the issues concerning the GERD Dam. The GERD Dam is an issue of national water infrastructure for Ethiopia. It hosts 85% of the waterways and has had zero rights under historic, unworkable, and dysfunctional colonial treaties, dysfunctional in this day and age. 66% of the rights have gone to Egypt, 22% of the rights have gone to Sudan, and I think I'm correct in saying that Sudan has only been using a third of those rights. But this is an opportunity to not just help eradicate poverty and to support a lot of Ethiopia's sustainable development goals, but it will bring great things to the region. And we're seeing a lot of short-term political interests catering for Egypt and catering for US foreign policy, which is pursuing, you know, economic security through access to clean and green tech metals. And so the issue concerning the GERD and bringing this issue to the UN Security Council yesterday was something that I thought was very unhelpful. The African Union is an organization that the US and other leading organizations like the European Union has tried to support and empower over the years. African leaders have proven to be some of the best and most affected dialogue facilitators in the world and peace resolvers. And yet we seem under pressure from Egypt and the United States to be bypassing those channels that we've all supported for so long, and turning some of these issues into aggression towards Ethiopia. And one could argue that it may be Ethiopia today and other sub-Saharan African countries tomorrow that may be the target of what seems to be short-term proxy interests.
So Eleverji, sort of following up on that, the GERD, the Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, I know the narrative is that this is an aggressive government that's committed aggression in Tigray, and the framework for that, building the dam as a way to try to deny water access downstream to Sudan, Egypt, et cetera. How much is this conflict then being cited as a way to try to put pressure on Ethiopia on other issues by regional partners, like the dam or other sorts of issues?
I think it's important to note that the international concern with the Ethiopia predates the Tigray conflict. And going back a couple of years now, the concerns have been there about the dam. Whether they are merited or justified is another question, but the point is that they predate the conflict. Since Abiy Ahmed has come to power, as Johannes has also mentioned, there have been security challenges in large parts of Oromia, but also in other parts of the country as well. There have been lots and lots of people displaced from various parts of Ethiopia outside of Tigray, in addition to the people who've been displaced in Tigray. And so all of these issues cumulatively have led to a degree of concern about the situation in Ethiopia and the way in which the country is headed. I don't think the Tigray conflict is primarily of concern to international community partners and others because of its leverage possibility for the GERD or other issues. I don't really think that's the case. I think the main reason that there is this concern over Tigray is twofold. One is because of the dire humanitarian situation that has been caused, where it is now the case that almost everyone who lives in Tigray, certainly every family, is food stressed. And a lot of people are in crisis, not everyone's in crisis, but also because of its potential and all of the complications that were arising due to Eritrea. So the GERD concern would have been there whether the Tigray War existed or not. And I don't think the Tigray War is necessarily helping Ethiopia's public relations when it comes to the GERD. That's certainly true. And so it makes it more difficult for them to advance what is, as Anne said, a legitimate case for the usage of the Nile waters. That doesn't help their case in that sense. But I don't think it's necessarily the other way around, that international actors see the Tigray War as an entry point to get what they want in the GERD.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Ethiopian conflict and its implications on the region and prospects for resolution with Ali Virgi of the U.S. Institute for Peace, Anne Fitzgerald of Wilfrid Laurier University, and Johannes Jadamu of Georgia Gwinnett College. Now, at this point, what can international actors then do to try to promote a resolution to this conflict? The humanitarian stories, the humanitarian narratives have certainly been quite shocking. The community, the people living in Tigray have been suffering tremendously as a result of this conflict. What's the best way out of this to try to resolve the conflict and try to bring a more lasting peace to Ethiopia? Anne Fitzgerald?
Well, I think dialogue and discussion and healing and reconciliation are all very critical to the way forward. I think we've reached a fork in the road with the tensions between the region of Tigray and the federal government of Ethiopia, which takes us either more towards potential succession and independence for Tigray, which would be a great shame. It's the birthplace of civilization. It's Tigray's played such a role in Ethiopia's history and its liberation struggle. And we could talk for hours about the integral role of Tigray in Ethiopia. But the people have demonstrated in many corners that they support the TPLF. And the TPLF is at odds with the central government. Now, we have a unilateral ceasefire declared by the government. We've seen some preconditions that the TPLF have put down on paper for them to come into a ceasefire arrangement and talks. But we've also seen a position from the government that deems its ceasefire to be very unilateral and in support of humanitarian efforts and the interests of the Tigrayan people, the farming season, the Tigrayan communities have gone through a lot in terms of agricultural productivity over the last couple of years. The crops have been badly affected by the desert locust swarms. And so we've seen this space open to hopefully support that. And as Ali said, to decrease the food stress that some communities are experiencing. But I think that if a stakeholder group of some sorts, and it may be the same stakeholder group that the government has been having these back channel discussions with, made up of business leaders, made up of religious leaders and academicians within the region, maybe those discussions can continue and be supported, and a distinction can be drawn possibly between those who were connected with high crimes that the government does not want to engage with and those who discussions can be made possible with. I mean, this path is not a completely untrodden path. There are aspects of Northern Ireland that resonate with this situation, in so much as we had a group that was deemed by some to be a terrorist organization. We had a political group as well, and the Good Friday Agreement was struck with that political group, giving Sinn Féin representation, a weapons decommissioning process that was done in a very subtle and face-saving way that gave the space for more political participation, more apathy towards the cause. Yes, we did see a splintering of the IRA into different sort of factions. And whether or not we might see similar things happen in Tigray, I don't know. But if ongoing talks and consultations do go forward, then space should really open up for multi-party politics, for people to be made aware of the political platforms of those different parties and what they can bring to the people, rather than what the people can bring to the party, which has been part and parcel of the political culture of the past.
And Johannes, I know there's been this call for, you know, greater national dialogue to try to resolve these issues, to try to end the war and to try to promote a more stable peace. Anne highlights the TPLF as a challenge here. First, is it about trying to transform the TPLF or representation in Tigray to something that's more supportive of a stronger central government? And then ultimately, what is the promise of this national dialogue?
National dialogue absolutely is something that I would think is the only solution that could end this conflict, that could usher a new era of socio-political reality in Ethiopia. But I think it will still be very, very challenging to even discuss the prospect of a national dialogue, given that it takes at least two tangos. So the TPLF considers the current administration illegitimate. They do have this openly declared sentiment against Abiy Ahmed. And chances that they will have the interest to negotiate with the central government, the federal government rather, would be very unlikely. And I think, in part, just like Anne said earlier, the Tigrayan is overwhelmingly behind the TPLF, and that is also one major reason that the ENDF had to withdraw, because they just found out that they were not actually fighting against the TPLF all along, but they were actually fighting almost 6 million people that are behind the insurgency and the guerrilla fighting. So that definitely will be some sort of, you know, encouragement, the TPLF skills, and, you know, as some sort of ammunition that it can use when it comes to plotting its next move. So that's why they also demanded very, very unacceptable in the eyes of many Ethiopians, demands for them to be able to negotiate and actually accept the unilateral ceasefire that was declared by the government and, deciding one of their own too. But nonetheless, I think here, like your question implied, of course, the international partners had a role to play. And one primary, solution that they can think of is, of course, treating both sides the same way. For example, since the ANDF withdrew, which we now believe actually started to happen almost close to a month ago, along with the Eritrean forces, but it was not declared. In fact, some of the military victory that TPLF claimed was when one of the army Tembien area of Tigray was withdrawing, so some information was actually gained by TPLF. So they had ambushed this, kilometers of convoy of the ANDF, and that was what led to some casualties and even some prisoners of war. Now that may be in the hands of the TPLF. So anyway, I think the international partners must be able to also criticize the TPLF about what it's doing. Let's say has gained the control of the Tigray region. I mean, thousands, I mean, of Eritrean refugees that had fled Eritrea because of persecution and fear of persecution, and that were living peacefully in Tigray. And some of them actually going to school, working there, you know, enrolled in universities. They were killed. Muslim Tigrayans who have always been, you know, suspected of anti-TPLF sentiment. You know, Tigray is a very majority Christian region. So they were also killed. And of course, other Tigrayans who were suspected of collaborating with the federal government. So they are now suffering from the consequences. But no one from the international community is actually calling for any sort of investigation or criticizing TPLF for failing to protect in the areas and citizens where it's controlled. But again, national dialogue is definitely the way forward. National reconciliation is something that should happen right after that. And especially, you know, as I always say in most of my writing, it's a forward-looking national reconciliation, right? Without, of course, we cannot forget and erase the past, but if we focus more as a country on the future, you know, I mean, no Ethiopian, I mean, to my understanding, actually looks at an Ethiopia without Tigray. It would be very, very difficult to imagine an Ethiopia without Tigray and without Tigrayan brothers and sisters. So I think the only way to get out of this mess and this situation is, of course, national dialogue and national reconciliation. And I hope the Tigrayans, instead of, you know, doing what Taliban is doing, which is, you know, declaring victories and talking about this political and military truce, they would rather sit down and just do and think and do what is best for the people of Tigray and the people of Ethiopia at large. And that's national dialogue.
Ali Verje, this last question. We have about a minute left. What would you propose would be the best international response to try to bring some sort of resolution to the conflict?
I think there are three things the international community can do that haven't yet been done. The first is to not put the Ethiopians or the TPLF on any pedestals here. There are things that have been done on both sides that I think both sides regret. I hope they would regret it. And that are no one has clean hands in this. But the international community can move beyond the condemnations to actually provide and facilitate more of a forum for the discussions that we've been talking about, the negotiations that we've been talking about. The second thing is to help reinforce a possible ceasefire. Yes, there are problems with the declaration the government has made. There are problems with the preconditions the TPLF has laid out, but that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be further moves towards some kind of sustainable ceasefire, building off the small opening that we have here. The third is to consider how to address some of the other sub-national conflicts and issues in Ethiopia, because these are also really important. There are, as I've said, many, many, many people displaced across the country. There are many people in need of humanitarian assistance across the country. Much of that support is coming from the international community. And it isn't just enough to think about the emergency response. There needs to be in cooperation with the authorities, in cooperation with the communities, more sustained effort to address the challenges that are happening at these levels as well.
And with that, thank you all very much. Ethiopia is such an important country, large country, a country with a remarkable history, a country that has shown so much economic promise, and the need to resolve this conflict is so incredibly salient. I'm going to thank our panel today, Ali Verje, non-resident senior advisor to the Africa program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He is the author of Five Steps to Sustain a Ceasefire in Northern Ethiopia. Anne Fitzgerald, director of the Balsillie School of International Affairs and professor at Wilfrid Laurier University's Political Science Department. She is the author of Ethiopia, A New Proxy Battle Space. and Yohannes Gendamu, lecturer of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The Politics of Contemporary Ethiopia, Ethnic Federalism and Authoritarian Survival. Thank you all very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.